Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. On May 9th, the Philippines held their presidential elections. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. won the election, bringing back the infamous family toppled in 1986 in a popular revolution. What does this say about the memory and the political climate of the nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On May 9th, the Philippines elected Ferdinand Marcos Jr. as its next president. He's the son of the former dictator of the same name. The election was not close. Marcos secured double the votes of his nearest rival, Lenny Robredo. The vice presidency was won by Sara Duterte Carpio, the daughter of the outgoing president, Rodrigo Duterte. The outgoing president has been criticized by numerous human rights groups for violence in the nation, particularly calls for violence against drug users and drug sellers. On today's show, we will explore the historical significance of the return of Marcos to power in the nation. We will explore the political and social climate of a nation whose democracy, and in particular, whose liberal commitment to human rights, seems to be facing a significant challenge. Our panel today is Jocelyn Martin, Assistant Professor of English at Ateneo de Manila University in the Philippines. She is the author of Martial Law as Philippine Trauma, Group Culture, the Sacred, and Impunity in Three Memoirs, and From Dictator to Hero, Marcos, Hero Cemeteries and Sites of Cultural Memory. Teresa Encarnacion Tadem, Professor of Political Science at the University of Philippines Diliman. She is the author of Philippine Politics and the Marcos Technocrats, The Emergence and Evolution of a Power Elite, and the Politics of a Middle-Class-Led Movement in the Philippines. And Nico Revenia, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the co-author of Deadly Populism, How Local Political Outsiders Drive Duterte's War on Drugs in the Philippines, with Renard Sexton and Dotan Haim, and the Philippine elections, Has Politics Changed Under Duterte? Thank you all for joining us. Jocelyn Martin, let's start with you. You've done quite a bit of work on the memory of the Marcos regime, the regime that was toppled by the People's Revolution in 1986. His son is now president. Do Filipinos just simply not remember the previous Marcos?
Well, that's a big question. It's more complicated than that, yes. Maybe out of just to give us a context of what has happened and to remind our listeners, you know, who Ferdinand Marcos was. And these are information from, for example, Transparency International, which says that Ferdinand Marcos is the second most corrupt official in the world after Suharto. That's an information from Transparency International. But we also know, and it is recorded, and these are facts, that during his regime, martial law regime, the Ferdinand Sr., 34,000 were tortured, 70,000 were imprisoned, over 3,000 were killed, and they have stolen over $10 billion. And it's significant to know that he was exiled in Hawaii, welcomed by then President Ronald Reagan, who were friends actually of the Marcos family in 1986. So that was, we can say, a generation ago. So it's one generation before, you know, and he died in 1989. So he was exiled. And when he died, the family actually tried to secure a place for him, secure a place for the body in the Punchbowl National Memorial Cemetery, where 21,000 military died. You know, they stay there, but this was refused, which was significant because that meant a second exile, in a sense, for the body, because that was a state cemetery that refused him. But then the body returned in 1993. Under Fidel Ramos at that time. The body was returned to Batak, Ilocos Norte, you know, the loyalist part of the Philippines. So it didn't pass through Manila. It didn't pass through the Hero Cemetery. It went directly straight to Batak, Ilocos Norte. That was 1993. And it's significant to know that in 1995 already, Imelda, So the famous wife, you know, the Imelda Marcos already secured a seat as a congresswoman in Ilocos. And that was just 1995, just 9 years after 1986. I found that really quite telling already, because it was just a short time from 1986 to 1995. So the return of the body sort of ushered also the return of the Marcoses. There wasn't illustration, you know, this preventing of officers from coming back to power at that time. So it's to answer your question, this is a long-winded way of answering question. There is a generational divide where the generation at present do not have lived memories of the 1986 revolution, but also because of the fact that the Marcoses did return. There was public prosecution, but they never spent a day in prison. You know, Imelda never spent a day in prison, although she was indicted. So that's something. And then there was no collective memory viewing of restitution, although there were some manner of restitution from Hawaii. So these are some things that complicate the fact. I can discuss later about the cemetery, but I'll stop there for the moment.
And Teresa, one thing that I read from the new president is he said, evaluate me on my policies, not on my family. So how much is Marcos trying to separate himself from the family legacy versus kind of running on the fact that he is the son of the former dictator?
Yeah, it's definitely or desperately trying to separate himself from the Marcos family, from his father. But at the end of the day, he is associated with his father. I mean, there is nothing he can show as a track record that has done this on his own. So in a way, it's really the Marcos name, but not only the Marcos name, the Marcos network. And maybe this is where I'd like to add also with Jocelyn, why memory is so short. Because remember, the Marcoses had such a big network. A lot of elites especially benefited from them, not so much from the masses. Okay, so if you even just take a look that the next president after Carson Aquino, as Jocelyn mentioned, was President Ramos. President Ramos, who was Marcoses' National Defense Secretary, only to abandon him during the last days of people power. Right? I mean, and he's also the second cousin of Marcos. You know, somehow there is a relationship there. Who followed Ramos? Joseph Ejercito Estrada was a staunch Marcos loyalist, right? So in other words, the Marcos votes were still very strong, even after People Power Revolution. If you take note that President Ramos just won by 24% of the vote. If the Imelda Marcos and the Dandinko Wangko votes joined, they would have won over Ramos, but they did not. So in other words, the Marcos power base is still there. But going back to what Jocelyn was also saying was that it's very true. There's a systematic revising of history books, very systematic, a lot of money being poured in. So that really helped a lot. So in terms of the policies, I think when Marcos Jr. says the golden years, he's going back to the promises of the 1986 EDSA revolution. He's going back to that. And people are saying, what happened to us? The post martial law appears after Cory Aquino, he had 6%, 7% growth. We were among the fastest growing regions in Asia, next to China, but he did not, don't use the word, it's out of, I'm sure Nico says, it's passé, trickle down. And it did not reach. So people are saying, what are you talking about the promises? So I think people, in a way, the memories are short, but they're also reliving a reality that the inequality has increased. Inequality, billionaires have become richer. So when Marcos Jr. comes in with the policies of before golden years, it's part of what Jocelyn was saying, erasing memory. At the same time, it's also living a reality that their life they see is no better. So there is something that they are holding on to. So I think in terms of the policies, he's been the most opaque. I mean, he's been opaque. You don't know what the policies are. You don't know, right? And that's why people are asking, who are his economic managers? Because the only thing the business community are concerned now is he going to continue the policies which have favored us? It has brought growth. It has brought billionaires out of them, but that didn't necessarily benefit the majority. So these are the kind of policies they're waiting. And Marcos Jr. is not just talking about it. He has electoral promises. his policies, electoral promises that he will, he'll end liberalization policies like rice tarification, which has affected the rice farmers. And if you look at it, there's a parallel to Marcos Sr. When Marcos Sr. declared martial law, the first thing he said was agrarian reform of rice, right? I mean, that was what he promised. It was addressing the majority. And that is what basically Marcos Jr. is all saying. I promise that I will address policies like liberalization policies, rice tarification, which has made more lives more miserable for the farmers. So we'll see how he will turn out, but the audience is the same. Okay.
Nico Ramania, you have written quite a bit about the rise of populism in the Philippines. And my perception, at least, when Rodrigo Duterte was elected, was that he was at least a different type of leader or came from a different group. First of all, how true was that, that he really was an outsider? And is this, you have a piece that asked, has politics changed under Duterte? Have they?
Right. Well, thanks for having me here, Douglas, to begin with. But to answer your question, I think there is a part of former president or current president Duterte that is, in fact, different from sort of the run-of-the-mill traditional politician that we see in the Philippines, in the sense that he is, in a lot of ways, an outsider. When he stood for office, there weren't a lot of mayors aligned in his political party. It was only towards the end of his candidacy that it became apparent that he was actually popular. And then once he became the president, then it seemed like he would continue to be this sort of outsider. But if we look at the data closely and what he's doing, what he was essentially doing is replicating the traditional way by which politicians maintain power in the Philippines, which is you slowly win over these local patrons within this, you know, wide network of patron-client relationships, the ones that are actually able to deliver you the votes, win them on your side, and then you realign politics so that you then become the new patron in Malacañang. So if you look at the 2019 midterm elections, that's exactly what happened. So everybody jumped ship from Liberal Party, bandwagoned on his political party, and then he was able to get reelected now with this sort of insider network within the government. And so in that sense, you know, he started sort of as an outsider populist, but then he managed to realign politics from within and rely on sort of the tried and tested ways of maintaining power in the Philippines, which is, you know, one of the potent ways is to rely on this network of patrons. And then that's how he managed to stay in power, remain popular, despite sort of these questions about his dubious policies at the national level. And I think that would segue into how Marcos was actually able to sort of ride on that wave of populist support through his alliance with the daughter of the president, Sara Duterte. So just to, I know this isn't your question, but like just to sort of connect this answer to what has been said so far, I think I totally agree that there is this collective memory that is different across generations that Jocelyn was talking about. And then on top of that, there is this idea that the people, I think this is true from my observations and from my studies, that the Filipino people have actually been sort of discontented with how democracy played out after 1986, which is what Teresa was talking about. And if you have this combination of no strong memory of history, plus discontent with liberal democracy, plus the ability to actually mobilize these very, very potent clientelistic means of mobilizing support, then you have sort of this trifecta of mechanisms for winning support. And that, I think, is exactly how it played out. And the recent presidential elections in the Philippines really sort of illustrated this very well, because the stark contrast between Marcos's approach and then the Robredo campaign's approach is night and day. Robredo, she like really stood for, okay, I am going to be this once in a generation politician who's going to run on my track record, on my competence, on my honesty. I'm not going to engage in revising memory, revising history. I'm not going to talk about you know, like the discontent of the Filipino people in this like hand-waving way. I'm going to talk about policies, and then I'm going to try to be the good leader that you ought to have as a Filipino people. And of course, we now know that that's a losing strategy. But I'll stop there because I know Teresa and Jocelyn will have many more to say.
Absolutely. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the recent Philippine election with Jocelyn Martin of Ateneo de Manila University, calling in from the Philippines, with Teresa Tedem of the University of Philippines, Diliman, also calling in from the Philippines, and Nico Ravania from the University of California at San Diego. Teresa, you want to respond?
Yeah, maybe I'd just like to also add to what Nico was saying. Okay, Duterte, right, he was an outsider, was from Davao. But I think what was important, what is, he was not carrying the baggage of what they call the yellow versus the Marcoses. Because he had no baggage. With Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, it was like Noynoy Aquino de Yellows versus GMA. Duterte had no baggage. So he could get along with the Arab Estrada people, he could get along with the Ramos people, he could get along actually also with the Liberal Party people. So in that way, he wasn't carrying the black and white baggage of GMA versus Noynoy. I think, just to add to what Nico's saying, that was very important. But secondly, I think what the business community is also looking for, and they're rest assured, is who are his technocrats, elite managers. It's like Sunny Dominguez, who was actually the agriculture secretary of Corazon Aquino. And he is part of the Manila elite. He is Davao-based Manila elite. So in other words, what was rest assured for the business community was the economic policies are to continue. So what I always say is that presidents come and go in the Philippines, the economic policies are hegemonic. It's basically the same. And that is what the elites are actually looking for.
Actually, Teresa, if I could follow up too, it seems like so much of Philippine politics, really since the end of the Second World War, since independence, has been this backlash against leftist movements or creating an image that there's some movement that could potentially, overwhelm the country. I think of, the role that the communists, will play at the immediate end of the Second World War, since they were the ones who largely led the fight against the Japanese, and then the reformist movements in the 50s, which eventually is what's going to lead to Marcos's election. It seems like that's been a pretty consistent feature of Philippine politics. Is that still what's going on today? A narrative that the right, and you're saying the business elite, have to control politics because any form of reform could end up opening up for, some drastic change in the country?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because even during the Commonwealth period or any form attempt to form a socialist party has always been crushed with the help of the CIA. So in other words, our elites have had it very good. There was always a third force in the U.S. to crush this. So there was really a strong anti-communist. That's why they were saying that Marcos Sr. was the biggest recruiter of the NPA because of all these human rights violations. Or they're also looking if Marcos Jr. will follow the path, if he follows the road to repression, military repression. So even if you look at the why Philippine elites continue to rule, there's no alternative being even offered by the left. If you look at Leni Robredo's slate, she didn't even want any left people in her slate. So even the most left of that is Bayan Muna. She didn't want to have anything to do with them because of red tagging of the communist, the communist scare there. And even President Duterte, because of he saw that the war on drugs was not really getting anywhere, so he shifts his attention to communism. People in the University of the Philippines, recruiting, being red tag and everything. So he shifts the narrative to the communists is the bigger threat, but they're not actually the threat. So in other words, in electoral politics, there is no alternative being presented. So if you present this to the people, people will say, oh, is it Leni Robredo's Nico? Say, is it the same? Will this be the same? Right? That is how she is seen. And then you have this made up all golden years of Marcos. So even the left, the strategy was really... you go with traditional politicians. If you go with traditional politicians, you cannot raise issues of inequality because you're going to hit the hand that feeds you. So, and I think that's the first time there's a socialist candidate in Caliodi de Guzman who raised socialist issues, called himself socialist. It's equivalent to your Bernie Sanders, where the longer time socialism was so taboo until the economic crisis really hit people and then it's now open. The Philippines, we're not yet there. we're not yet there because traditional politicians still continue to rule. So there's no alternative being offered, but at the same time, I can also sympathize, empathize with the left because of the way the military repression is. So even if you're not left, you're organizing from the ground, medical professionals, health professionals, lawyers, which are just human rights issues, you get killed. So I think that is the kind of atmosphere which is also being propagated for any kind of opposition, whether you're left or not.
Jocelyn, Teresa just said something I found, you know, particularly interesting in talking about the way this golden age of Marcos. That it's clearly a memory element there too. We've heard here in the United States stories, some of which seem pretty fantastical about this golden age, others just sort of describing, you know, the elder Marcos presidency as the good old days. What's behind some of this, you know, this narrative?
I was just going to talk about the golden age as well, because it's really, really an old tactic in a certain sense. This is nostalgia politics. And we know how many politicians, you know, let's get back the good old America again. Let's get back a good old age again, as if we can return to the past. But the past, as someone said, is a foreign country. You know, we cannot really move back to the past just because the elements are completely different. And this is what Svetlana Boym calls as the restorative nostalgia, which can be very weaponized and politicized. So we feed the populace with an idea of a sort of golden age of the past, which is completely, of course, historical revisionism. People here say, oh, if you don't vote for him, then don't cross the San Juanico Bridge because he did that for you, you know. So they resurrect all the infrastructures, basically, that Marcos Sr. and Imelda Marcos also built during those ages. Of course, we know that they are these edifices, these constructions, these infrastructures during those times are sort of extensions of themselves. You know, these are designer hospitals. They weren't really needed. There's the infamous film center where a lot of workers perished just because Imelda Marcos tried to hurry the building of it. One writer, Gerald Lico, called it the edifice complex, you know, of the Marcoses, which is a play on words. And they had this vision of themselves being the mother and the father of the country and fashioning all these buildings as an extension of a modernized Philippine house where they are the patrons. But it's like them really playing Disneyland in my sense, you know. It's not a Disneyland, but a Marcos land where the country is their playland, and they build all these infrastructures. And what's the funny thing about this golden age, again, this golden age myth, is it's an extension of a fantasy that they have built up since a long time. You know, so many people can talk about this myth-making machinery of the Marcoses, the mnemonic, this memory machine, entrepreneurship of the Marcoses since a long time. And in his campaign, Bongbong Marcos has weaponized this golden age myth, which actually belonged to his father. So these are credentials of Ferdinand Marcos Sr. And at the same time, when we criticize him, he tries to separate himself, you know, but the son is different from the father. So it really depends on what is. So there is a paradox here. I get the credentials of my father when it suits me, but then all the crimes of my father, when they don't suit me anymore, I detach myself from them. So there's a complete paradox per se in this discourse.
No, absolutely. And Nico Ravagnat, we've got this idea of this golden age, but also you have the very, very recent, you know, past, or I mean, literally, it's actually still present with the Duterte presidency. You know, how does that mix? Because I mean, at some level, I guess I'm tempted to say, you know, how much is Marcos saying, let's make the Philippines great again, and something that an American audience would certainly recognize, but it's not necessarily a repudiation of Duterte, is it?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things that that's going on here in terms of how the Marcos is sort of harking back to the golden age in his campaign relates to sort of what recently happened during the Duterte administration. I think the first one is, it's really during the Duterte administration that we begin to see sort of this activation or, you know, weaponizing of modern technology, especially the power of the social media as an agent for amplifying whatever is fed into it. And as it happens, at least, you know, we see this more clearly at the beginning of the Duterte administration, the way that they've managed to use that. I think there's truth to the fact that the Duterte administration orchestrated, as you know, like these trolls that people are talking about. There's now evidence that that's been going on before. But whether or not they've been the ones who started it, once they were there, these trolls, that sort of like jump-started this machine that just keeps on going and going. And in some ways, the Marcos campaign, whether or not they actively participated in it themselves, or they just rode on sort of this momentum, actually used it to their benefit to, again, like add nuance to this golden age myth-making storytelling on social media. Because the really compelling thing about what's percolating on social media is that there are some bits of truth to it. Exactly what Jocelyn said, like, look, we've built this and that. We've actually built some of the most grand buildings in Manila. We've built the windmills in Ilocos Norte and so forth. And then you combine that with all these sort of like narrative and myth around the golden years, then it becomes really powerful because then you begin to believe that, yes, it's probably true because there's bits of it that are true and we see today. So that's the first one that I think that's true about sort of how the Duterte administration relates to the Marcos campaign. I think the second thing that's true is that the sort of the Duterte administration sort of in some ways reinforced this, for a lack of a better term, the populist base of the voters. These are the ones that are, again, discontented with the how liberal democracy played out in the Philippines. They're the ones who are willing for the state and whoever occupies it to actually sort of remove the democratic institutions that serve as checks on the power of the leader. And these people have actually never gone away, right? So now all you need to do is to activate it. And how do you do that? Again, this goes back to using the narrative of the golden years. And if you are a campaign that's trying to optimize on just winning the most number of votes, then you would employ this, what Jocelyn said, is a paradoxical strategy, which is you're going to like bring in the benefits of your dad's accomplishments, but then distance yourself from your dad's sins. And then as long as you're able to control the narrative on, you know, the powerful social media platforms, then you can really like reshape people's minds and then, you know, like mobilize their discontent. And then that's very potent means of winning their votes. And that's true because in the Philippines, you don't have any other information shortcuts as voters, apart from your personal affinity with the politician. There's no partisanship, there's no political ideology. And so what's left is your personal affinity. And if you can find a politician who actually sort of echoes your sentiments, that's a powerful thing for you to support that person. And again, Marcos and his campaign was really good at doing that, but the Robredo campaign was, you know, for all intents and purposes, actually did the exact opposite.
When we come back, how will Marcos govern the Philippines? What policies do we expect of this new Marcos regime? How might they differ from the current policies of Rodrigo Duterte? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. President Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines had turned against the United States and threatened to align with China. Now it appears the Marcos regime will follow this trend. What does this all mean for geopolitics? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Jocelyn Martin, who's an assistant professor of English at Ateneo de Manila University. She's joining us from the Philippines. Teresa Tadem, professor of political science at the University of Philippines, Diliman. And she's joining us from the Philippines as well. And Nico Ravania, an assistant professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Teresa Tadem, I'm going to turn to you because one of the things that struck me about the Duterte presidency was just how distinctly anti-American his rhetoric and certainly some foreign policy elements within that presidency, in particular, what seemed to be an invitation for China to, at a minimum, balance against American power, if not replace the United States. Does Marco share that same antipathy towards the United States right now?
I think in terms of President Duterte, it wasn't as if he planned a foreign policy, just giving too much credit to him. I think he's a very knee-jerk person. And I think somebody mentioned when President Obama told human rights, that really got him raged, right? And though he shifts to China and then he has business dealings with China now, you know, things like that, that shifts him. But then when the COVID-19 came in, vaccination and all, then he shifts back, you know, he accepts from the US. So in terms of, I think, Marcos Jr., I think he'll be less volatile as President Duterte, but I don't think he'll have a foreign policy planned in a way that Marcos Sr., I think that's, again, giving you too much credit. So I don't think he has any really plan. I think he'll just be pragmatic and see how it goes. And I think what maybe is going for him, Marcos Jr., is the U.S. reaction, that they don't want another repeat of Duterte. He pivoted to China. So right now, they're even asking my colleagues who are the choices for Secretary of Foreign Affairs, you know, who are these people. So I think they're more on their toes now because they don't want that radical pivoting. So at this point, I don't think Marcos Jr. has any policy, whether articulated or not articulated. So I think it is really more of the U.S. on how they will play, that it does not pivot radically to China or get more weapons from Russia, you know, things like that. So I think they're more careful now. I think that's how it is going to be. I think the foreign policy will still be basically the same. You know, Filipinos will still go to U.S. It will still be the priority, etc. Yeah.
And Nico Ravania, you want to respond as well?
I'm just going to add to what Teresa was saying. I totally agree that I think what's likely going to happen is we will have a foreign policy by the Marcos administration that's relatively the same and predictable, which is in some ways a good thing because then you don't expect this sudden strong pivot to China and or even sudden pivot to the United States. You never want something that's too strong away from the status quo in such a sudden move. And I also agree that I think the ball now is with the United States, which is that they need to tread this very carefully, exactly because of what Teresa said, which is you don't want a repeat of what happened in the Duterte administration. And how I would put it is in the United States policy when Duterte became president was they were doing a carrot and stick strategy. If you don't do this, if you don't stop with your drug war, we're going to take away your aid from the United States. And that did not work because Duterte actually called the bluff and said, Well, if you don't want, I mean, I don't care about your, you know, your aid. We don't care. We're just going to move on. And the United States realized that they cannot credibly follow through on that threat because it's in their national interest and national values, priorities actually remain to keep the relationship with the Philippines. And so that's what they don't want to do. Now, the tricky part with the United States during this Marcos administration is that we know that Marcos, at least the family, has this outstanding, what is it called, a contempt ruling by a U.S. Court of Justice, which then means that, you know, once they step into U.S. soil, they're probably going to be subpoenaed. And so the United States has to very carefully tread that situation. Right? What do you do? And I think, and this is me like putting on my hat and making predictions, or at least what I think the United States should do is they should proactively do something about this tricky situation before it becomes an issue. That, I think, is going to help them win over, or at least keep the Marcoses from leaning more towards China.
Yes, Teresa, you wanted to respond as well.
Yeah, I think I also want to add to what Nico was saying. I think it's very also important because, okay, Xi Jinping has reached out to Marcos Jr. are the business dealings. Because I think what pivoted also President Duterte to China is he got an economic advisor, right? Was in was that close to the people in the Chinese embassy. So in other words, there were, and they had this family scandal about, you know, what was this people, the advisor of President Duterte being part of the scandal. So in other words, I think it's also important, the money part, the business part. And maybe I'd like to make a parallelism to Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. This was the war on terror, and the U.S. was so fixated on the war on terror. And little did they know that Gloria Macapagal Arroyo is doing business already, like the telecommunications, all of these business deals with China. And they go, and they, oops, wait a minute. You know, China, Philippines is now get so close to China with regards to that. So I think that is also very important to watch out for. I don't know if it's a personal interest, and this business interest can now impact on foreign policy, like the Spratlys and all, you know, because we need now China, they're investing already. I think that's another thing US has to watch out for, because China is money. China has money, and that can also reach to the pivoting, which will affect geostrategic interests also in the region.
We're talking a lot about the business issues. Going back to the question about the elder Marcos and the memory, there's really two key issues, right? There was the corruption question and depriving the state of resources. And then there was also the violence. I know you've written about martial laws as PTSD, you know, et cetera. It seems that what's signaling here is that the business community is saying, you know, we're really going to watch some of these, you know, potentially some of this corruption. But does this open the door potentially to a lack of attention on questions of, you know, of human rights, which I know, you know, Duterte was in particular called out on?
Yes, this is really something I think everyone is watching out for. And part of the answer or query towards the policies of Bongbong Marcos and Sara Duterte, now as very significant as well, that Sara Duterte is elected as vice president. And Teresa did mention that we don't know their policies. You know, every time they would campaign, they would just brand this policy of unity, which is a very vague concept. Unity, but we don't exactly know what it is. It's as vague as other logos, such as the true, the good, and the beautiful, or the mother and father, or Filipino, which they usually have branded out in the past. And we know that Duterte has a human rights case opened in the International Court in The Hague, and that Marcos Sr. has now stolen a place at the Hero Cemetery in Libingan ng mga Bayani, you know. So we suspect that, or some of us do suspect that the policies of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Sara Duterte, some of them would be to clear the names of their fathers. So behind this policy of unity might be uniformity, actually, with regard to an acceptance or a revisionism of history. And as far as human rights are concerned, yes, we don't know if Marcos Jr. would be as violent as the father, or Sara Duterte would be as violent as the father. These are things that we have to look out for, but I suspect that they would be in power in order to also assure other people to be in power, in order to at least slower the process in The Hague. And now the PCGG, so which is the body that tries to get back the Marcos wealth that was stolen, it has now been dissolved. And I suspect that there would be other cases like this, bodies that would take back the wealth. They might also stop it, you know. So I think both of them are there in order to slower at least, or stop whatever policies there are in place right now, in order in order to stop justice actually from functioning.
And Nico, I know there's been a lot of narrative here in the United States that the election of Marcos is a threat to Philippine democracy. One thing I've noticed is that since the People's Power Revolution, elections have been held. The Philippine democracy has been consistent, at least if defined by, you know, by holding elections. Are there any real threats that Marcos Jr. might be tempted to use a populist forum to maybe undermine the democracy? Or at the end of the day, there really is not as, nearly as much threat of, you know, to the electoral process in the Philippines, though certainly potential threats to liberalism in the Philippines.
Right. I think exactly what you just said is what's going to happen, which is in terms of the democratic or the democratic institutions part of that word or that term liberal democracy. I think, you know, it's fair to say we've had peaceful transitions of power throughout the last three decades since 1986. Well, I mean, except for maybe the Exodus revolution. But in terms of the electoral institutions, that's, you know, like one of the hallmarks of democracy, it's fair to say that the Philippines has been good in that aspect. But to go back to this question of what aspect of this liberal democracy is going to likely be under threat, I think this goes back to what Jocelyn is saying, which is, remember, you have a president that's incoming who has this baggage of outstanding human rights cases against their family. And my biggest worry is that in the first 100 days, at least, if the losing opposition sort of mobilizes and attacks the incoming administration and asks them to be accountable to all these outstanding questions, that the Marcos administration will then use all of its recently garnered political capital to actually just protect the interests of the family. And that includes, you know, appointing nepotistic people into power. And that includes what Jocelyn had said, like delaying all these legal proceedings and making sure that they use the government, the state institutions, the state apparatus to advance their own interests. That's probably the way in which liberal democracy will be undermined. And so in other words, what I'm trying to say is, right now, I think Marcos, at least in my reading, he is this, you know, run-of-the-mill politician. He's not going to change much of the status quo. He's going to try not to do what his father did, because he's got a chip on his shoulder, to be honest, as someone who will try to sort of distance himself from the bad image of the father, I think. But if he is threatened, or his interest and his family is threatened by the opposition, I think he might actually use his power, especially because now he has this, not only does he have the very strong political institutions, like the presidency in the Philippines has historically been a powerful political institution, now he has this overwhelming support of the popular vote. And those two are very potent sources of power that if he is forced to use to advance their interests, then that's definitely going to undermine liberal democracy. But hopefully it doesn't happen. Right now, I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm interested to hear what Jocelyn and Teresa thinks about, you know, the situation with when it comes to liberal democracy, if it's likely to be undermined or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And Teresa, I was going to turn to you and then first and then to Jocelyn, because Nico made a point that I really wanted to drive home too, which is it's not just that he won the presidency, but he won it overwhelmingly. So, I mean, that's a political mandate. What's he going to do with this mandate?
Yeah, definitely. He has the mandate. And what will he do with it? I think I go with what Nico is predicting. That, I mean, he will implement policies, but not policies that will undermine their family interests and as well as the political elite network with him. And maybe I'd also like to add, I totally agree with what Jocelyn and Nico said. So about he'll be subtle as compared to this Marcos Sr. martial law era. But take note, his first appointment to the cabinet is Sara Duterte. And what was the department? We're all expecting the stereotype Department of Social Work and Development. No, it's Department of Education. How much more subtle can you get? It's very in your face. it's controlling the minds of children. And it will pursue what Duterte Sr. has already been doing with what's at burning books. Imagine burning books, which has not only Marxism on it, but also anything that is anti-martial law, including children's books now, like Adarna, right? Jocelyn Adarna, children's books. And here is Sir Duterte saying, I'm going to implement military training for high school people, you know? So it's all there. And they know that they will pursue the Duterte policy of the anti-terror law, which gives more leeway for the military to arrest any kind of opposition. You also have that national task force on the elimination of local communists, etc., which has been going against any voice of opposition. These are policies which are still there. It will remain. So I think that was very crucial, the appointment of Sara Duterte, the first appointment to the Department of Education. It is controlling the minds. It is continuing where they have started, and worse, institutionalizing it. That's a scarier part for liberal democracy for me.
So you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the recent Philippine election with Jocelyn Martin of Ateneo de Manila University, with Teresa Tadem of the University of Philippines, Diliman, and Nico Ravania from the University of California at San Diego. Jocelyn, you wanted to follow up as well?
I wanted to say the same thing that Teresa just said. Right now, I think it's very significant and scary that the first appointment is Sara Duterte as education secretary. Yes, it really signifies a rewriting. It poses several questions. What would the effect be on textbooks? What would the effect be on curriculum? Would there be a history of martial law in the textbooks already, which is already rare? And would martial law government websites take down what has been there before? And it just sort of follows what has already happened with all the trolls and the poverty of information, in the sense that people really rely more on TikTok and Facebook these days rather than on editorial boards, peer-reviewed research, checking sources. So these factors of non-checking, non-peer-reviewed, relying on sources that are self-publishable, you know, self-produced, yes, these are really enemies of too much information. We're not anymore in a generation where there is lack of information, but too much information that anyone can just have, you know, at will. And we know that the Philippines is very much an online country. You know, there is too many people spend their time on TikTok. And so that's where they also get their information. And there is a very difficult line between information and education. People don't necessarily educate themselves with too much unchecked information.
Nico, now when I think about how online Filipinos are and sources of information, I'm reminded that the largest Filipino expat community is in the United States. I mean, the ties between Filipinos in the Philippines, Filipinos in the United States, the family ties, et cetera, it seems to me there's an opening there that the U.S. is going to play a potentially significant role in information flowing into the Philippines, probably not formally, but I think informally through family networks. Or am I being too optimistic about the types of conversations that families have when they're in contact with, you know, their loved ones who are in the United States?
Yeah, so this is an interesting and tricky question to answer because, well, first of all, a disclaimer, I'm not studying sort of American politics and understanding the Filipino-American communities here in the United States. But my limited understanding of the sort of the distribution of PhilAms is that there is actually a significant share of PhilAms that are actually heavily supportive of the Marcos regime, both in the past and of this incoming administration. And so it's not clear to me that the United States will be able to sort of take advantage of the networks of Filipino Americans in the United States as a mechanism for, in some ways, influencing domestic politics back in the Philippines. Now, that said, I think remittances, the money that gets sent home, is a powerful mechanism for these families abroad to actually influence the thinking, the culture, the sort of the consciousness, the social consciousness of their relatives back home. And for as long as we continue to, at least on the side of the United States and at least on the side of Filipinos abroad, for as long as there continues to be ways for them to actually remember the past, in other words, like use current technology to actually reinforce facts, reinforce the correct version of history, I think that feeds into their relatives at home alongside their remittances. And the combination of here's the economic incentive, here's my influence, keep, stay vigilant in terms of the information that you receive, that's going to make a difference. But I am increasingly growing, I'm increasingly becoming skeptical that that's happening, because actually my firsthand impression, and this is anecdotal, is that there is this reverse force in which the Filipinos that I've interacted here in the United States are far more influenced by sort of the changing ethos, the changing narrative that's going on in the Philippines. And it's actually kind of scary the way the Filipinos here, at least a fair amount of them, talk about how exciting it is that we now have Marcos in power. And so it's a scary thing.
Absolutely. Teresa, you were going to respond to that as well.
Actually, if you look at the Filipino community, there's a generational gap. I mean, the older generation tend to be Republicans, conservative, right? And then the younger generation are Democrat. But maybe I'd like just to add to what Nico was saying. There's an organized Filipino network there, which is identified with the left. They're organized, but to what extent the percentage of that they can influence. So mine is also quite anecdotal. Take note, a lot of Filipinos who go there are middle and upper middle class. They're not your domestic workers that go to Taiwan. And so they're middle class, they're educated. So I think that's important in terms of democratic values, but to what extent are they mobilized? Sometimes they just get too engrossed with their day-to-day lives, how to survive US society with all this inflation now, that they will not really bother with Philippine politics. But maybe an indication I'd like to see is the voting of the OFWs who voted in the US. What was the percentage? And I predict, I think probably, right, Nico? Probably it will still be a Marcos Jr. vote. So quite conservative. And maybe just another thing, I know someone who did a film on Imelda Marcos, and when she told the daughter, oh, you have to vote, she goes, why? So in other words, the younger generation have no feel for the Philippines. It's the generation which felt martial law, but it's also a generation who fled, who went to the US, even during martial law period, and they couldn't really care less about the situation here. But of course, anecdotal, you have a lot of what they call balikbayans with attorneys who were for Marcos Jr., coming from the US and also coming from Canada. So I would give a split, maybe more positive, Nico, split. Okay, not really favoring, but there, I think that's really the reality of it.
And Jocelyn, I'll give you the last word on this about how optimistic or pessimistic are you about the next 4 or 5 years in Philippine politics?
I'd be very cautious. I'm more pessimistic, I suppose. One other thought I had as well is that we had a vote for Marcos Jr., who banked on the shadow of his father, but also before we had Duterte, the highest vote in the Senate went to Robin Padilla, who is this macho figure, but also Randy Tulfo, who is also this macho figure. So there's still this attraction towards very toxic masculine figures, you know. Even the vote for Sara Duterte also shares the shadow of her father. And even her, she has been caught punching a police officer. So in a sense, she too shares this toxic masculinity, if I could say that, you know. So there will be a question for human rights for me. Human rights will continue. The poor, as Teresa was saying a while ago as well, this will still be a place for the elite. Where will the poor be? So also academic freedom will be at stake, press freedom, red tagging, maybe. So I'll be very cautious, and we would really rely on the vigilance also of the international community to help us get out of this disinformation stage.
I think that's a great place to end. We've been discussing the current state of politics in society in the Philippines following the election of Ferdinand Marcos Jr. to the presidency. Our panel today has been Jocelyn Martin, assistant professor of English at Ateneo de Manila University in the Philippines. She's the author of Martial Law as Philippine Trauma, Group Culture, the Sacred, and Impunity in 3 Memoirs, and From Dictator to Hero, Marcos, Hero Cemeteries and Sites of Cultural Memory. Teresa Encarnacion Tadem, professor of political science at the University of Philippines, Diliman. She's the author of Philippine Politics and the Marcos Technocrats, The Emergence and Evolution of a Power Elite and the Politics of a Middle-Class-Led Movement in the Philippines. And Nico Ravania, assistant professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the co-author of Deadly Populism, How Local Political Outsiders Drive Duterte's War on Drugs in the Philippines. That's with Renard Sexton and Dotan Haim. And The Philippine Elections, Has Politics Changed Under Duterte? Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agasian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.